All right. So today it's my great pleasure to hand it over to Ian. I'm really looking forward to hearing from you, Ian. It's all yours.
Thanks, Jim. My name's Ian, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Well done, Bridget and Julia, on your birthdays. I was 9 months, just earlier this week, and it's been the first 9 months that I think I've ever had when I haven't been under the inf well, I haven't been dabbling in whatever, in different substances or alcohol or painkillers or benzos or you name it. And it's a brave new world, shall we say. And I'm really, really enjoying it. It hasn't been easy, and a lot has happened, and I've got quite a lot to unpack. I do feel really quite nervous about it. This is the first time I've been asked to share in this new kind of new time or new existence, I suppose. I've shared a few times before, but I'd never really been honest or really kind of known that this is what life actually is. Today I'll just talk about what I did today. I woke up really early, as I do these days, and me and my wife took our dog for a walk down the beach, and it was really, really cold, but it was great. Feeling the North Sea coming into your face, and the icy wind, and then we got a coffee, and then came home, and then I went out with my daughter to buy some a few wee Christmas presents for my wife, and then I came home, and I finally set up my drums. I've got a drum kit up in the loft, and I've got myself an electric drum kit as well. So I've set up my drums for recording, and I've got the electric drums to practice on. So I've had a really full and happy day, just doing wee jobs, but in a really kind of relaxed manner. I think if it was this time last year, I would have been up in the loft, manically making all my drums, and I would have done it so quickly, and then I'd been like, right, what's next? And then I would have been completely obsessed about that, and then I would probably taken some Valium if I'd been asked to share to calm me down, and then I would have shared. And I don't know what I would have spoken about, but like that's kind of how normal the lying about being sober became, you know. But I suppose if we go back to my childhood, I had quite a good childhood, quite a happy childhood, until about the age of 8 or 9, and there was a really significant trauma in my childhood, and I never addressed it until never addressed it fully until I suppose I was in rehab 9 months ago. But basically, it wasn't either of my parents' fault. I won't go into details of it, but basically, it was like having my dad sort of taken away from me. And we had a big car accident, and my dad broke his back. That's what happened. And it went from being a really happy house to a very, very angry mother and a kind of vacant father. And it was just a sad place to be. Like, you didn't want to really talk. You couldn't ask my mum anything because you just knew she was angry, just angry at the world. There wasn't any kind of religion or anything like that in my house. I think my mum, there was for my mum, like she grew up in Glasgow, and the church was a big part of our life, I think. But yeah, that when she met my dad, my dad's like a proper kind of Republican, communist, very political man, and he kind of changed her mind, I suppose. So yeah, I do remember my mum going to church after my accident, but just coming back even angrier. So yeah, I just didn't want to be in the house, and did everything I could to get out the house from an early age. And because there was so much happening with my dad and him trying to get his life back together and that, nobody really noticed I was gone. So I was just out all the time doing mischievous things, I suppose. And yeah, then in my teenage years, I was always active and doing things, and I got really into music and was always playing music. But because we were out and about in the streets all the time, started smoking a lot of weed. And at the beginning, I just absolutely loved it. I just remember that feeling it gave me. It was like just went into my own little world, and I took great comfort in it, and I've just started doing it all the time, all the time. I had quite a morbid fascination with drugs. All my heroes were hellraisers, and I wanted to be just like them. And so I started playing music and doing what they did and thinking that was great. Also quite at an early age started taking a lot of drugs that they gave heroin addicts back in the sort of mid to late 90s. I don't think the NHS really knew what to do with the heroin kind of epidemic that was happening. So we used to get hash off these heroin addicts, and sometimes they didn't have hash, so they could just give us other things. And I do quite vividly remember taking different benzos. I don't know what they were. We just called them things like green eggs and blues and yellow ones. But I remember just a beautiful feeling. It was just like being covered in a blanket, and I just wanted to feel like that all the time. So yeah, used to take drugs and play music with some guys, and big psychedelic freakouts and stuff like that. I do remember my mum always saying, like, you'd be good if you learn how to finish songs. So yeah, in my I managed to get through university, and I never really tried. That's a big regret. I never really tried academically. It was just like half-hearted, but that was enough. It was enough just to pass exams. I had to do lots of resits and things, but I got through it. And then in my 20s, I just wanted to try and make it as a musician. And I was always playing the drums, but I suppose deep down I did want to be the front man. But I always figured out the bit, like I was always quite precise about with my measurements of substances before playing. I remember that, being quite calculating about a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of that, just to optimize the plan. I got it wrong a few times, but yeah. And then I took off to see the world, and I got myself a year work visa for Australia and went off there and just got obliterated drunk in Australia. I got sacked from different jobs for being drunk, but it was all good fun, all good fun back then. It was happy days. But I do remember thinking I do drink more than other people. But drink wasn't really the my go-to thing. It was always drugs, until they started doing all the uppers, like all the pills and speed and cocaine and stuff. And I just could not handle the come downs on that. And I remember going for a couple of pints, and I remember the second pint just removing all the fear and anxiety. And that's probably when drink became a big solution for me. So the drink kind of took over, and it remained like that for most of my 20s. So yeah, if you look at like the places I've gone and lived and worked, it looks really, it's pretty spectacular. I've lived in France, I've lived in Madrid, lived in Argentina. But the truth is, when I was there, all I did was drink and just get fucked out my head. There was I always went to these places because of a girl, and that girl would always leave us because I was a fucking mess, and I seemed to kind of wallow in heartache and pain. I seemed to almost love it, in a kind of perverse way. But I was all, I suppose the best way to describe Ian in his 20s is I was very much a kind of had this romantic idea of the world. A real kind of dreamer, and everything had all these, I was very impressionable, but everything, I had all these romantic notions of all these different places and things like that. Which is a really good thing, because I think that's really what I was. And then the drink and drugs came in, and I just became really, really kind of cynical about everything. So I had these kind of, two sides. Just a real contradiction. And Yeah, they just sort of existed in my head, this snarling, horrible cynic, and then this like footloose kind of guy with romantic ideas about places and music and stuff. And yeah, it went on like that for ages. I met my wife when I was still at school, and we went out for a bit, and then we split up. But then I reconnected with her, and I had a period of kind of being really happy. And then me and my wife went off and started teaching English in Vietnam, and it was good for a while. And then I really started drinking again, really drinking. And then my daughter was born in 2012, and a few months after my daughter was born, we went to my aunt and my cousins in Australia, and I was looking forward to meeting up with my cousin because he was a Hellraiser who played music in bands and stuff like that. But there I was, sort of 31. I was about 16 stone, just a big bloated mess. And I was excited about meeting up with him and just going out and getting absolutely wasted. But it turned out he'd been going to AA for a month and was sober. And all I really remember is getting blackout drunk on Christmas Eve. And I went to my first AA meeting on Christmas morning. And I don't really remember much of it. But then after that, I kind of knew that I had to stop drink because it was just making, I was such a messy drunk by that stage. It was just such a messy drunk. And I just couldn't hide it. Just constantly just topping up. I just couldn't hide the fact I was drinking. So if I think about it now, I hadn't properly surrendered. I just sort of, I was like, right, drink is not working out for me. Everybody knows that I'm when I'm drinking. So I went to Vietnam and I did embrace AA, but I did it in my own way. And in Vietnam, you could buy quite a lot of pharmaceutical sedatives and things over the counter. So I just started popping them. And then we sort of came back to the UK, and I went to the doctor, and the doctor prescribed me some of them. And I did take them quite sparingly, just for anxiety and things. But I'd never, and all this time I'm still going to meetings. I've got a sponsor. I'm just sort of got this little secret. And then at some point I started taking little bits of codeine, until basically I became hopelessly addicted to codeine. And I would stop and I'd go through a couple of days withdrawal, and then I'd have a few weeks without any, and then I'd start doing it again. And I don't really know why. Well, I suppose I do, because I'm an addict. But the really fucked up thing is I'm still engaging in AA and it went on for so long that I'm kind of lying to everyone, but inside I'm kind of deeply ashamed. And I'm becoming more and more and more cynical and just really quite a toxic person. Like, my thoughts were just so toxic. Do you know? There was still like a fraction of me inside that knew everything that I was doing was fucking wrong. And I was lying and I wasn't sober. It was like a full-on war inside my head on a daily basis for the best part, 10 years. You know, it was when I think about it now, it was absolute torture. Having to have this kind of double life. I did stop doing as many meetings. I came into to Tasnua. I did a couple of relapses on other substances and got caught, basically. That's what it was. It wasn't a relapse. I got caught taking different things. I just saw him and said, "What is it?"
Can you open this?
He closed the door. Sorry, that was my daughter. And I lost what I was talking about. Yeah, I called it a relapse, but it was just basically I got caught. It was just really messy. I like to keep it just so I could take enough just to feel sedated. Do you know? I didn't, well, not to feel anything. I didn't want to feel. I didn't know how to deal with any emotion. I couldn't handle any emotion. I didn't want to feel too happy, and I didn't want to feel sad. I definitely didn't want to feel sad. Just didn't want to feel anything. So I was taking a bit of this, taking a bit of that, taking a bit of this. Basically, like, I've lied to every single person. I've lied to every single person here. I've lied to every single person I know. Do you know? It's just remarkable that that was okay. Like, you know, some of the language they use in AA, it's pretty true. Like, I mean, cunning, baffling, and powerful. That's what it is, you know. Sort of tricked myself. So yeah, basically, the finale was earlier last year. I was taking so much street Valium and so much codeine that, you know, I'd looked into how to get off it, and I was quite naive with the benzos. It wasn't last year I looked into getting off them. It was longer ago than that. But I do remember being like, "Oh shit," you know, how serious it is to get off them. And that's basically when all the lies just came crashing down. And I remember people in here trying to give me advice. And I really, really appreciate that. But I was still in kind of denial. I can handle, I can do this myself. There was no way I could do it myself, you know? And by this stage, my wife knows And she's trying to help me get off it, but I just couldn't. I couldn't handle someone else being in control of all the pills that I was taking. I basically had a nervous breakdown. I remember just being on the floor crying and trying to punch the floor. My wife had moved to her parents and taken my daughter. I'd agreed to go into a rehab. My parents were helping me. People in here, I'm talking to people in here. I can't remember some of the conversations. I was so fucked by that time. And I remember going, having to do all these things, having to get a sick note, having to talk to the rehab, having to, I don't know what else, book, buy a train ticket. And it was just too much. It was just too much for my head. And I went to the co-op on kind of autopilot and just bought a bottle of vodka and came back to the house and opened it in the bathroom and just took a drink that was just terrifying. It was terrifying how easily it went down, you know. And it could have been about half a bottle that I just drank, and I didn't even really taste it, you know. And then everything just went calm, and I was like, right, okay, let's go to the doctor first. And I went to the doctor, and everything kind of fell into place. And then I went to rehab, and I'm still, you know, still not fully kind of accepted the situation. And they've put us on a tapering thing. I vaguely remember coming into a meeting here and just sharing and just crying after some guy had shared a beautiful share, and in comes me, just like this fucking mess, do you know? And then it was a couple of days into rehab, I met my key worker, this wee hard woman from Easter House in Glasgow, called Kirsty. I don't know if you know Easter House, but it's a rough place. And you know, all she was an addict, she is an addict, and she's like, so what's your story? And I started, you know, oh yeah, I've been sober for before and blah blah blah. And she's just looking at me like I'm a fucking lying piece of shit. And yeah, she just saw through it all and just goes, have you fuck been sober? Have you fuck? And I was no one had ever spoken to me like that. And I just broke down and cried. And she's like, you know your problem, Ian? You've never surrendered. You've never surrendered. And my whole world just came crashing down. But it was weird. It was a weird feeling. It was like relief. And then she was really kind to us and helpful. Helped me a lot, and we did a lot of therapy and stuff in the rehab. And yeah. I spoke to my wife and she said, I think that's the end for us. I can't see us being together. So I'm in rehab and I've just got this horrible shame in my gut, and I've lost everything. I truly believed I'd lost everything. You know, where my wife, you know, was really kind of so matter of fact about everything, not in a nasty way. Just matter of fact, you know, and just saying, look, I want Peggy Sue. That's my daughter's name. I want Peggy Sue to have a happy dad. You need to sort yourself out. And I was just, you know, again, my world came crashing down. But somehow I was able just to focus on getting clean and sober. It was horrific coming off of the street Valium. It was, I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. Yeah, it was really nasty, really nasty. So after 28 days in rehab, I came out and I spent some time in Aberdeen. I spoke to a few people, and then I went and stayed with my big sister and just kind of continued to get my head together, I suppose. And I did a lot of AA meetings and the place where my sister lives, and my sister helped me sort out a wee flat. I stayed in this wee flat for a month. I went back to work. Just these huge waves of anxiety, huge, massive amounts of anxiety, and nothing to help reduce them, you know. But I didn't ever feel kind of the urge to take anything, you know, after kind of seeing where it taken me. I went back to work. I'm really grateful that I've still got a job. They don't know all the details of it. They don't need to know. And slowly, I started seeing my daughter again. It was amazing just spending time with her and just being, yeah, just kind of looking at her for the first time. So yeah, and now where I am now is I've got a kind of routine every week, but there's quite a lot of things that have been happening in my head. And the biggest thing is this idea of self-will. I just never understood what it was. I just couldn't get my head around it, you know. I kind of said in previous times, going through the steps and things, that I kind of understood what it meant. I believe I think I did. I did actually have this idea of what it was, but I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what self-will was until listening to a few different people share about it. And that expression in AA when they say let go and let God, that I didn't get that. I didn't understand what that meant. It wasn't practical to me. I wasn't having anything to do with any kind of higher power concept. But when I heard, well, Jim actually pointed that out, this guy in Tasnua shared about how he interpreted it as letting go of all the things, all his ideas of how things should and shouldn't be in the world. You know, what people should and shouldn't say, how people should and shouldn't act, how work should and shouldn't be. And that for me is my self-will. Trying to control everything that's happening, And when things don't happen, being like, that's an outrage, or seeing people with nicer houses than me and being like, I should have that house. He doesn't deserve that house. Or I should have a nicer car. Why does he have a nicer car? He doesn't deserve a nice. It's just warped, just fucking warped thinking constantly. Constantly, 24 hours a day, just warped thinking. Do you know? That's what my head was doing for all my life. Just that, just fucking madness, just mad thinking. And just the other week at the local AA meeting, there was a guy started sharing, and he was talking about self-will and higher power and stuff. And he spoke about truth and how this concept of a higher power, he calls it truth. And I can identify that. I can identify with that a lot. Truth is so much more powerful than me. And the moment I start telling the truth, it's totally out of my control what happens. And that is very humbling. And I like that. And I think the truth helps me, is helping me be a bit less self-centered. It's such a big, scary thing, the truth. But the moment you tell it and show vulnerability, people connect with you. And it's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. It's just a great thing. So today I'm emotionally available to my daughter and my wife and my mum and my dad and my sisters, especially my daughter, because she's going through, a lot of changes. She's 11 now. And I'm just present. I'm just here. I'm able to do my job better. I'm finding more patience. That's about it. It's a good place to be. And that's it. I'll just leave it there. Thanks.